Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, Adam, we'll be talking with Dr. Ileana Perrin, Associate Professor at UNC in the Department of Pediatrics, about childhood obesity, an increasingly significant problem in our country, and we're going to speak with a research expert on the topic.
Speaking of expertise, Christy, we have some important research that matters from some of the leading journals in the country.
We do. The first one is about pap tests and the frequency of getting a pap smear.
Second one is about arthritis of the knee, something none of us want, but a lot of us have.
Also about alcohol misuse and risky drinking.
And finally, about the common cholesterol medications and cancer. Well, let's just dive right in, Christy, and let's talk about pap tests. Both you and I are family physicians, and almost all family physicians do pap smears frequently on women.
And perhaps we've been doing them too frequently over the last several decades. The new guidelines came out by the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, or ACOG, which mirrors some of the research we've talked about on our show from the Preventive Services Task Force about the frequency of pap tests.
Yeah, this was published also in the journal Obstetrics and Gynecology, appropriately, and suggesting that certainly if women at certain ages have had normal pap smears, they don't need to have them every year. And we've been saying that it could be up to 3 years, and now they suggest for certain women ages 30 to 65 that you might even be able to expand it if they've had normal ones even past 3 years, up to 5 years.
So the bottom line is that the recommendations say women from ages 21 to 29 should have a pap test no more than every 3 years. If you're 30 to 65, the best option is to have it with this HPV test you can get. And if that's normal, every 5 years. And then beyond that, there's no evidence to continue doing the pap smears.
And women younger than 21, they say, should not be screened for cervical cancer at all. So this is a radical change from what we were taught, Christy, at least in our as medical students, perhaps. And it's transformative, I think, for many women and our listeners. So talk with your doctor, ask them about the new guidelines, and then decide what's appropriate for you.
It's important to note that most still recommend having an annual well woman or preventive checkup, even if you don't need the actual pap smear, to look at all the different prevention recommended for your age.
I think the group of this American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology should get a new acronym, though. ACOG, Christine, is not a...
It doesn't sound very good.
It doesn't sound very good. Well, let's talk about our next research that matters, though, about a common condition, arthritis of the knee, and what are the interventions in physical therapy that may work? I get asked this all the time.
Me too. This is osteoarthritis. It's a leading cause of disability, causes a lot of pain, and you want to have options to treat it and help people have relief of pain before they have to have surgery or to try to ward off a surgery intervention.
And this was research that was published in what's called the Cochrane Library, which is a library that all these collect data from all these different studies to answer questions. And this particular one was 84 different studies that looked at 13 different type of physical therapy interventions on arthritis of the knee.
And what they found in combining all the different studies was that there is low strength evidence that aerobic exercises, aquatic or water exercises can improve disability, and that exercises with water, with aerobic and with strength and with ultrasound can reduce pain and improve function in people who have this osteoarthritis of the knees.
The bad news is that this was low strength evidence, meaning this wasn't an overwhelming effect. And we talked about last week, Christy, I think, about how studies tend to tout a lot of benefits, and sometimes in practice they're not quite as great. So what this tells me is that physical therapy isn't harmful. It may have some benefit here, but it may not be quite as great as others, and it may depend on the physical therapist and other factors we don't know yet. So a lot of unknowns here.
They also didn't combine. Most physical therapists are doing multiple different treatment modalities to help people, and so they didn't look at the combination of these things. But I think if you hurt and you have this option that's relatively low cost and low risk, that it's safe and it's worth a try in case it helps.
Stay tuned. Talking about does it help or not, this next research that matters, I think Christy and I will both say it helps and it's a low-cost intervention.
This is about the topic of alcohol misuse or risky drinking. I mean, this is a leading cause of preventable death in the United States. It's a big deal.
And this research was also in the Cochrane Library, and they looked at 23 different studies of people who perhaps drink too much. Now, not people who were alcoholic, but perhaps people who drink too much, like college students or young adults or adults who maybe are having a couple drinks a night. And what happens when the physician gives them advice that to stop or to cut back on their drinking?
And the best evidence were for these brief interventions where there were multiple times that a provider gave 10 to 15 minutes of counseling about the importance of reducing drinking.
And what happened is in the studies that those who got this advice decreased by 3.5 drinks per week from what their baseline was compared to those that didn't.
And fewer adults, 12% fewer adults reported having heavy drinking episodes, and 11% more people reported drinking less than the recommended limits. So when they tried to put this over a year and combine it all together, it looked like it really might make a difference overall in public health.
And having college-age students, Christy, I was really in tune with the finding that college students had reduced consumption and fewer heavy drinking episodes.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no harm from this type of advice. So this is a clear-cut win-win as far as I'm concerned.
It's possible that people had selective reporting after they knew a little bit more about how much they should or shouldn't be drinking. But I do think this is very inexpensive. And if we can reduce accidents and liver damage from people cutting back, then it's worth it.
It's a cheap drug in terms of the advice.
That's true. Let's do this last one, which is about statin drugs.
Cholesterol-lowering drugs called statins. And this question about whether or not there's any relationship between the use of these and maybe cancer getting worse, growing faster, or perhaps it's slowing down. What happens when people who have cancer take these statin drugs?
So the thought is that without cholesterol floating around, that cancer cells can't divide as well, and so they might not grow and spread as much. So they look to see for a group of people who had cancer and who are already on these statin drugs compared with people who had cancer who were not on these drugs, and followed them out over time to look at mortality or death.
And it turned out that comparing those who were using the statins, and again, all these patients in the cancer, they had a reduced death from any cause as well as a death from cancer. And this was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, a study of tens of thousands of people with statin who had cancer.
And so, I mean, further study is certainly needed, but this suggests that patients who are already on these statins, it is linked, it's associated with reduced cancer-related mortality or death, so that shows some promise.
Right. It doesn't mean, though, that if you have been diagnosed with cancer, should you start a statin?
It doesn't answer that.
That's the next research that needs to be done. So make a distinction there between whether you were on statins and got cancer, in which case you should definitely stay on your statins, versus should you start a statin or not. That's a conversation you need to have with your doctor. We don't have the data.
So we've talked a little bit about statin use and perhaps reduced cancer mortality.
About physician advice, it should be there if you drink more than the recommended amount, and it will cause you to drink less.
And about physical therapy interventions for knee pain from osteoarthritis, some perhaps benefit, be it small.
And finally, the longer length of time that many women who may be getting pap smears once a year can certainly be able to begin to move safely in conversations with your physician to 3 and sometimes up to 5 years.
So that concludes the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Eliana Perrin about childhood obesity. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're going to be talking with Associate Professor in the UNC Department of Pediatrics, Dr. Eliana Perrin, about childhood obesity. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Perrin.
Thank you. Thanks, Adam.
Well, Dr.
Thanks, Christy.
We're so glad you're with us. And this is a topic that it comes up a lot on the show, I think, as Adam and I are talking about issues that are really important to our nation and to children. Childhood obesity has more than tripled in the past 30 years. I mean, each time you see a new statistic, it's just overwhelming. But I wonder, how did you become passionate that this is your thing you're going to research and do something about?
Well, it's interesting. I don't think I was super interested in it as a medical student, but when I was a resident, I was a resident at Stanford University, and we did our clinic at Santa Clara Valley. And there were so many overweight kids that I was seeing, and it just seemed like a tremendous public health problem. And when I decided to go into research pediatrics and academic medicine, I actually was more interested in restrictive eating disorders, things like anorexia nervosa and bulimia. But when I got to North Carolina, everyone said, you know, gosh, the much bigger public health problem is obesity. Can you help us with that? And, you know, there just seemed to be such a great need at that point.
And I know it's not either or. And as a pediatrician, you see both ends of this spectrum.
Right.
Help us understand when we say pediatric obesity, the title here, what does that really mean? Because, you know, you see a baby, and my children were kind of big babies, but that doesn't really tell us much about, is this a health concern for a child or a youth?
Well, you ask a really tough question. One of our toughest problems has been defining what pediatric obesity is and just when to be concerned about it. I mean, I think we all think that chubby babies are adorable and perfect, and particularly for the breastfeeding mom, you know, are you really going to be upset when her, you know, baby is, you know, above some percentile that, you know, we researchers say is not okay? So you ask a very big and important question. So we have defined pediatric overweight to be a body mass index. And what the body mass index does is it just basically takes into account the child's age, the child's height, and the child's weight. And a body mass index percentile above the 85th percentile, when they did these charts back in the year 2000, is considered overweight. Above the 95th percentile is now considered obese. And we start using those charts when children are about 2 years old. So before then, we use something called weight for length, similar type of math problem for us to do. And we use above the 95th percentile. But again, when we get concerned, that's a much more controversial question.
Well, I want to talk more broadly for a second. That'll be maybe easier for you to break it down for what are really the most important factors that are contributing to this problem. I think a lot of us want to blame it on fast food, or we want to blame it that there's not enough exercise in schools. But What do we know about our country and its direction of weight and the main factors that are causing this problem?
Yeah. So it's
also a really hard question.
Also really tough questions. It is definitely multifactorial. So over the last three decades, and I think you're right to sort of pinpoint this problem, you know, most profoundly in the last three decades, we have supersized everything from our soft drinks to our dinner plates. We use fast food as our most convenient food option. We're getting much less exercise. Children are not going outside to play as much. They're not getting to school by bike or by walking as much. We are a society that loves our cars. We even have escalators up to the gym where we go to work out because we've sort of lost the concept of how to be outside and enjoying the outdoors in an activity-filled way. So I think this is very multifactorial. And just as there aren't easy sort of things to pin this on, there's not going to be easy fixes either.
Well, let's start at the beginning, and we'll probably work our way through, which is you see someone, give us a typical story of what you may have seen and how someone presents and how you first have a conversation. Do people know that their child is overweight or obese or not when you come to see them? What do you see?
Well, so basically, most parents of overweight children have never been told that their child is overweight. That's some research that we did actually just a little under a year ago. Was shocking to us to find that out.
So how do you can you think back on a recent sort of situation? How did you handle that?
So a lot of times when parents don't know their kids are overweight is when they're younger. They're in an age from about 3 years old to about 8 years old. And I have so many parents of kids in this age group telling me their children are too skinny. They're actually really worried about it. They'll say, "Doc, you know, I do everything I can to feed her. I take her to McDonald's. I give her French fries. I give her chocolate milk. I give her whatever she wants because I'm really worried, you know, she's all skin and bones." And then I weigh and measure that child, and I plot them on a standard body mass index chart. And many times what I'll find with a child like that is that not only are they not too thin, they may actually be overweight. And this is because children who are in that sort of 3 to 8 year old time period look really skinny. And so I think a lot of what my job is as a primary care pediatrician is to be reassuring to parents at this time point, to do the important screening that we need to be doing, to have the conversations that are difficult for both parents and doctors to have. But to let them know that, you know, at this point in time, their child is not at a healthy weight, but that it's a great time to begin talking about this because I use the, you know, the old Garfield expression, "I'm not overweight, I'm under tall." And children are the only ones who really get to say that. They are not overweight.
Do the kids know who Garfield is?
The kids don't, but the parents usually do.
That's funny.
But I use it a lot, and it's wonderful for parents because they want to know when something is concerning. They want to get on top of it. Most parents are super concerned if you give them the chance. And from that point on, our conversation's about health. What are some healthy things that they can do to keep their child at a healthy weight?
Well, speaking of awareness, you're talking about that age range where children look very thin when they're at a normal weight range. But we've also got all these children who are increasingly obese.
Exactly.
And adults who are so obese. I had a conversation recently with a parent and grandparent of a four-year-old who was profoundly obese. But the family didn't see this because they're all sort of, well, we're big bones.
Yes.
And we were using an adult blood pressure cuff on this four-year-old child. It was really profound. But it was hard to get past sort of, well, he looks like everyone else in the family or all the other kids.
Yeah. I saw a 95-pound four-year-old the other day. So, you know, I hear you. I think a lot of parents, you know, their kids' schools, everyone's getting heavier. So their child doesn't look that unusual because the whole society is getting bigger.
But this is a problem with, I mean, what are the three or four, before we take a break, the three or four major concerns about childhood obesity? Because this isn't just the child being obese. It's a relation to what kind of health problems.
Exactly. So the older the child, the more likely there are to be health problems. But, you know, we're looking at things that happen to adults, too, you know, that you both know from your practice with adults. High blood pressure, diabetes, problems with joints, getting upstairs. I have families telling me he walks like grandpa. And he walks like grandpa because he's got too much weight on his knees. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the same problems that we see in adults we're seeing in kids.
Well, we need to take a short break, but we're going to continue talking with our guest, Dr. Eliana Perrin, about childhood obesity, or the Garfield...
I'm not overweight, I'm under tall.
I'm under tall. We'll be right back with your health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Adam Goldstein.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Eliana Perrin, Associate Professor in the UNC Department of Pediatrics, about childhood obesity. And Dr. Perrin, before the break, we were talking about just the challenges of making the diagnosis, of telling parents who are doing the very best they can, that there's a real health concern with the obesity, and there's the complexity of family dynamics, and wondered if we could talk a little bit about where to go from there. I feel like I'm doing lots of family meetings, and it's really, there are lots of challenges to make headway with who's doing the cooking and how to approach
absolutely.
That.
Families have so many barriers, particularly these days. It's such an what we call obesogenic society. Just all of, you know, everything is in the direction of trying to make you more overweight. So families are really fighting an uphill battle. And I think the first thing to do is to just be really empathetic about that and to try to understand some of the struggles. You have parents who are working two jobs. They don't have time to cook. They don't have time to go to the farmer's market to get fresh vegetables. I think the best thing to do is to really try and listen to hear what things, you know, are able to be changed.
What kind of things could in that particular circumstance, because I do hear this a lot, where do you start with that? Other than you hear it. I understand that piece because that's an important piece.
That's a really important piece. But what do you do next?
Yeah.
So I think, you know, the important thing is to really get at the shared values with the family. So most families, you know, like I said, are trying to do the right thing. And so, you know, maybe they think the television is not so good because it makes their kids hyperactive or they see violence on the television. Well, it doesn't really matter to me why they don't like the television. I don't really like the television. But one of the things that's hard is the television's a really good babysitter. It's really easy to turn on the TV and get a few minutes of peace and quiet. So what I suggest to families who are in that tough spot of needing a babysitter, needing to turn on the TV for a few minutes, is to really, you know, first of all, talk about it as a family and decide how much TV you're really going to let your kids watch. But the second thing is to not eat in front of the TV, because that's sort of making problems worse. So not only are you seeing all the advertising on the television of, you know, the sweet drinks and the, you know, calorie dense foods, but then you're also eating in front of the TV, and it's that mindless kind of eating where you finish a whole bag of chips before you even knew you were hungry. So that's
one happened to you too.
Yeah, definitely. It's happened to all of us, I think.
Yeah. And is a visit to a nutritionist or, you know, using multiple different providers, is that helpful to families, or do you find that most people sort of know?
Well, it's really interesting that you say that. I find that some families haven't tried some basic things. And so there's really some things that the primary care pediatrician or family physician can do to start off on the right track. And then, you know, for families that, you know, kind of have been through this before and they've tried some things, absolutely a nutritionist can be really helpful. And often nutritionists have food models and can really demonstrate portion sizes more than we're able to in the doctor's office. So that can be another helpful. And the reassurance that their kids are definitely going to get enough nutrition, because I think a lot of families worry when they cut down on portions that they're so used to giving that their kids are not going to get enough nutrition. And so I think nutritionists can be really careful about that in a way we sometimes don't have the time to do.
Actually, I was going to ask you just about this portion aspect, because a four-year-old, even an eight-year-old, doesn't necessarily control what they're given or served. And I remember a number of years ago when I was trying to lose weight, frequently I found that I ate whatever was put on my plate or if someone else served or wrote, you know, and I had to consciously make a decision to start asking for and or getting a much smaller portion on my plate.
Right.
What do we know about portion size and what do you recommend to parents?
Well, so I think portion size is really key, and I think families are kind of way off in what they think their kids should be eating. I often recommend the size of the child's palm is where to start, and since the child's growing, the palm grows, or the child's fist, whatever's easier. But basically, that's something that's going to grow along with the child. It's not saying a half a cup, because I think we don't know what half a cup means. It's not saying a serving, because I think we really don't know what a serving is. But it's saying the size of the child's fist, and I think that that's a good place to start. And a lot of kids will eat, like you said, what's put before them. And a lot of parents have a, you know, clean the plate club, but that's how they were raised, you know, so they want their child to finish what's on the plate. But if a lot is on the plate and that's the value of the family is to finish what's on the plate, well, then kids are eating too much.
Well, and another common problem that I encounter, and I actually think about my own concerns with my own picky eater four-year-old, is, you know, holding out and not eating or being difficult and picky about the healthy foods and finding ways, other ways during the day to graze on junk and to sort of fill up with foods that aren't very healthy. And so I wonder what recommendations or some common strategies for people to sort of focus on offering those healthy foods.
I think, you know, parents are in control of what they buy at the store. And so one of the, you know, cost-saving things I can do for them is to tell them not to spend a cent on juice or soda. They don't need to buy it. Water's free for most families who have safe drinking water. And that's a really great thirst quencher. Similarly, with the junk foods, they just don't even need to buy it.
They're not in the house.
And so that's something that families can do. In terms of trying to get kids to eat vegetables, I mean, that's a timeless problem. but I think, you know, really encouraging kids to like it, to try it because the chef, the parent, you know, prepared it, and to get kids to try things, you know, multiple times. Kids are what we call neophobes. You know, they're scared of new things, and so really trying things 8 or 9 or 10 times, it may take that many times before they like something. And also just recognizing that little kids go on what we call food jags, where, you know, they'll eat a lot one day and not anything at all the next. And I think it's really important for parents to realize that with their toddlers especially, they need to be looking week to week or month to month rather than day to day or meal to meal.
I know that you mentioned Garfield earlier. And Christy and I did some research Research That Matters a few weeks ago, where we saw that if you presented children like cartoon characters advocating certain foods, but it also makes me think that this is a preventable problem, right? There are
Some
cultures and societies in which childhood obesity doesn't exist as much. What do we learn from those societies? Because I know you're doing some research in this type of area.
Yeah, so we're definitely doing some work on prevention. And I think in all my time as a pediatrician, you know, the thing I hear the most from families is, I wish we hadn't gotten on that habit. Mm-hmm. And so it's so refreshing to start with a newborn or even earlier and just fostering good habits from the beginning. You know, certainly encouraging breastfeeding, which we know is related to preventing obesity. But if a child is bottle feeding, really encouraging the child to set their own what we call satiety or fullness, being okay with the fact that they're not going to finish a bottle every time, that all of us as adults have hungry days and more full days, and we don't always take the same amount. And so we shouldn't be concerned with the fact that our child usually takes 5 ounces, but today they only took 3. And what does that mean? Really looking to make sure that a child, you know, what their cues are to the parent, to tell the parent, you know, I'm full now, I don't need any more. Or as they say in France, the parents ask their kids, are you still hungry? They don't actually ask, are you full? They say, are you still hungry? And that whole sort of mindset.
It is a shift.
It's a total shift, right? If to expect, you know, to not be hungry at the end of a meal rather than to be full. So I think, you know, not getting into a TV habit, not getting into a juice habit, you know, working on portion size. Those are all the kinds of things we can do from the get-go. And I think we're going to help out parents in the long run by doing that.
So we've heard a lot of helpful tips, but I wondered if you might just summarize. You mentioned TV and portions, but if you had to, for a new parent, just give sort of list off the top 5 things to help with healthy habits.
Get your child outside and playing. Discourage TV, or if you do watch TV, don't eat in front of the TV. Have conversations with your doctor about your child's weight. Ask him or her if she's at a healthy weight, you know, and what you can do. Don't be afraid to have those conversations. And try and stay away from fast food.
Wow.
Excellent.
Those are incredibly practical, and I think most of those are inexpensive.
The fast food one, maybe not so much, but the others, yes.
Well, and perhaps when you do go out to eat fast foods,
really cutting down on the portion size or sharing.
There are other things on that menu, even
Absolutely.
If they're not as sexy. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Great tips. Very helpful. For our listeners who want more information, do you recommend the CDC website?
Centers for Disease Control.
Exactly.
Yes.
Or is there a particular place, reference that you think is good?
Well, you know, the North Carolina Eat Smart, Move More is a wonderful website and just a, you know, wonderful group of people who have tried to come up with strategies that are cost effective and helpful. So I think that's North Carolina Eat Smart, Move More.
And we'll put that
link
up on our site. And we want to thank you, Dr. Eliana Perrin, for coming and sharing your expertise and your compassion and empathy and support for families that have children or loved ones with obesity and overweight, and also ways to prevent it. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I get to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. We've got some good one today, Adam.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about the postherpetic neuralgia, fancy term for really bad pain after having shingles.
A child with a rash on the legs.
Someone who's written to us about stress in their job and in their marriage.
And about having an injury with a bruise under the skin.
Should you worry about it? Well, let's listen to our very first house call.
I had the shingles vaccine in the past, but I still got shingles really badly this year. I'm still glad I got the shot, as I can't imagine how bad this thing would be if I hadn't. My question is about treatments for that post-shingles pain syndrome, which I have. I'm taking ibuprofen and Tylenol as well as lidocaine gel. I take Vicodin at night, and I can't seem to get off the Vicodin and be able to sleep. Any ideas?
I am so sorry. It sounds like you did all the things possible to prevent that painful syndrome after shingles by getting the shingles vaccine, but you still had it pretty bad. Sorry to hear that. We do have some suggestions.
Yeah, and unfortunately, that doesn't mean that for all our listeners out there, you should still get your shingles vaccination, because most people won't get this. But if you've got it, the question is, what can you do? And there are a lot of things. It turns out that the pain medications like Vicodin don't do a whole lot more than ibuprofen. So that may or may not really be helping you, but there are some other medications that may help you that you're not taking.
So that lidocaine gel can be helpful. There are medicines called, there's one called gabapentin, which helps with nerve pain.
Some people know that as a brand name, Neurontin.
Even certain antidepressant medicines called the tricyclic antidepressants can be helpful for the pain. And there are other medicines, even something called capsaicin cream, which is sort of like, feels like hot peppers on the skin.
And that has to be used 4 to 6 times a day. If you use it less than that, it actually could increase the pain, but it depletes the substance that causes pain in the nerve fibers. So you really need to work with your primary care physician or even a specialist, because this is very painful and it can cause you to get depressed, and we really want to avoid that at all cost.
We hope that these tips are helpful and that you're feeling better soon. Let's take our next house call question.
My 12-year-old son had a rash on both outer legs. He says it started when he wore his football pads for too long after a game. It's still there after 2 weeks, and I see him scratching. Is there something over-the-counter I can do, or should I bring him in?
Well, that's a difficult question, and it gets into giving advice without actually seeing what's going on. And by this time, most people would have tried things like hydrocortisone cream over the counter. If you haven't, that's safe to probably use, but it may not actually work.
And it sounds like it could be like a dermatitis or inflammation of the skin from wearing that jersey for so long or those pants. It's possible it could be a fungus, kind of a rash or something else. So I think if it's been going on a couple weeks, and especially if you've tried over-the-counter cortisone, then you probably should get it checked out.
A lot of times, if it's that dermatitis that Christy, you mentioned, that kind of inflamed skin, putting hydrocortisone on it is kind of like spitting in a swimming pool to fill
it's
it up.
Probably
it's
not strong enough.
It's just not going to be strong enough there. So your doctor can do a simple skin scraping to determine if it's a fungus or not and get you on the right treatment. This is one we both agree. Probably bring the child in and let us take a look.
Let's take our next house call.
I have a lot of stress with my job and marriage. I'm getting older and it just seems like too much. Sometimes I take a medicine called alprazolam to help me relax, which works fine since I can just take it when I need it. My daughter has the same kind of stress, and her doctor recommended a medicine called Lexapro to take every day. That seems like an extreme medicine. Which one is stronger?
This sounds like a really complicated question, and it sounds like you're most concerned about sort of the difference between this Lexapro, which is more of a daily medication that can help with anxiety and depression, compared with the alprazolam, which is one of those medicines called a benzodiazepine, which is more like Valium, and can be addictive.
And in terms of which one is stronger and is one extreme or the other, it probably depends on your viewpoint. Some people might think that taking a medicine that can be a little bit more addictive, like a benzodiazepine, like this medicine that you're taking, is extreme. And some people might think taking something on a daily basis is extreme. In our opinion, probably neither one's extreme, and both of them may be right for where each of you are at right now.
I would agree with that. And I do think, you know, your situation and your daughter's might be different, although you may both have some anxiety that sometimes can run in families. But the answer is really in that relationship with your doctor, perhaps some counseling, and the medications can be a piece of sort of the more overall holistic approach to what's going on.
Yep. Combining counseling with medicine probably is better than necessarily either one alone.
So, agreed.
Good luck, and thank you for sharing that house call. Let's listen to our very last house call.
A few weeks ago, I accidentally ran into a table and developed a bruise that covered about half my thigh. It didn't look like any bruise I'd ever had. I didn't break the skin, but there were dozens of bright red spots underneath that looked like blood. The bruise has almost gone away, but now there's a hard knot underneath my skin and it's still really painful. Should I see my doctor or will it just take time to heal?
Ouch. That's all I can say, Christy. Ouch, ouch, ouch.
I know. And these things can take a really long time to heal. It sounds to me like it might have been something called a hematoma, where you can get sort of a sort of a section of blood right under the skin.
That's a fancy term for a bruise. A big bruise that's bigger than a bruise, really, because there's some blood underneath it. Right.
Right. And it takes a really long time to go away, but your body usually will just absorb it over time, but it can take months.
And, you know, should you see your doctor? Well, yeah, perhaps, because if it's still really painful, yet the bruise is resolving, sometimes those hematomas that Christy mentioned, they can get infected and cause, and cause some other problems. So, yeah, I think if it's still that painful, despite it resolving the bruise, I would probably see the doctor. I think that's good advice.
Or if it's getting more red around the area, and certainly if you had fever or any other symptoms, go get it checked out.
Well, thank you for sharing your question, and all of our listeners for sharing your questions and concerns. And if you have any things that you would like to send us for us to discuss on the air, please send them to us at yourhealth@unc.edu.
You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, our health app. If you search Your Health, which is one word, for a free download on iTunes, you can listen to us really easily from your phone.
We'd like to thank WCHL, UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and Dr. Eliana Perrin, today's our guest on childhood pediatric obesity. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
We look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.